this evening. It's a talk which I hope you will find interesting. I think part of my stimulus for being involved in this comes from my children and my grandchildren. I'm of an age where I learn far more from my children now than they learn from me. I have four. My eldest son, Paul, is a computer games designer and entrepreneur. He's a founder and creative director of a computer games company, or a nest of companies now called Mediatonic. Works all over the world on that. And he feeds me things to read, which help me take note of technology in the digital world. My second son is ordained, and my eldest daughter is a doctor, and my youngest daughter is a campaigner on environmental issues. And actually, what we're talking about is relevant to all four of those things, but it was Paul that got me interested. And my grandsons, I have four grandsons, and they're aged between 3.5 and 5 months old. And while I've been on this journey of learning about AI, I've been trying to think of the challenges that Josiah and Judah and Joshua and Caleb are going to face as they get older. I don't think they're ever going to need to learn to drive. I don't think they're ever going to own a car. I think the jobs and professions they engage with are going to be completely different, and their career pathways from their parents and certainly from their grandparents. And I think the way we shape the world that they are going to inherit is really critical, and we need to do the shaping now. So for the last 18 months, 2 years, I've been on a journey of learning. I'm a member of two groups in Parliament, an all-party parliamentary. I should start by saying, as part of my role as the Bishop of Oxford, I'm one of 26 Church of England bishops who sits in the House of Lords. And our role there is to say prayers, but also to join in the life of the Upper House of Parliament. I'm a member of the all-party parliamentary group on AI, which has been in existence for about 2 years, and a select committee, which is a much more focused short-term engagement of 12 people who sat over a year making a public inquiry, calling for evidence, interrogating expert witnesses, and producing a report in June, which is actually due to be debated in the House of Lords a week on Monday. So if you tune in, if you're really interested in the subject, tune into Parliament Television a week on Monday in the afternoon, and you'll see our report being debated. It's about so thick. It's a comprehensive overview of AI, a rapidly changing field. What I want to give you this evening is a snapshot of some of the issues that have emerged for me, and I've picked nine. Some of the principles which are emerging for our committee as the UK navigates its way through the challenges of artificial intelligence, and then some reflections on the contribution that the church and the Christian faith have to make at this particular moment in time. So that's my plan. There's a handout there. I'm not speaking from a script, but I will gladly make the slides available if that will be helpful. I've been on a really interesting journey in terms of what keeps me awake about artificial intelligence over the last 18 months. If you see reports of artificial intelligence in the newspapers, you'll nearly always see a picture of the Terminator robot. Whatever the headline, if it has artificial intelligence in it, then the story, there'll be a picture of the Terminator robot. And when I first began to engage with the subject, what kept me awake at night was the possibility of humankind developing what is called artificial general intelligence. Conscious machines, whether connected to a robotic body or existing virtually, but in effect, the creation of a new species of life. Now, there's much science fiction speculating about artificial general intelligence. This is the robot from The Terminator, but you could pick any number of other famous science fiction robots. There's also quite a serious philosophical literature, most notably Nick Bostrom's book, Superintelligence, which is speculating about the dangers of humankind developing a conscious superior intelligence. And there are well-known warnings from such figures as Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and others, saying we must be really careful about this. So that, at the beginning, was what intrigued me and kept me awake at night. Actually, when you read in detail, those developments in artificial general intelligence, conscious machines, and competent robotics in terms of responding are probably 30, 40 years away and may not happen. So actually what keeps me awake at night is not artificial general intelligence. What actually does keep me awake at night and has after several hearings is much more ordinary, narrow artificial intelligence, the processing of data and the capacity of machines to learn across quite a narrow front. And that's a concern about what the technology is doing now, not what it could do in the future. And that's where I'll be focusing this evening. And my symbol for that is not the Terminator robot, but a much more mundane symbol. And I would imagine most of us are carrying one of a different variety. And it's the Tesco club card. Or any other loyalty card. Other brands are available. The Tesco club card loyalty scheme was developed in 1994. And actually didn't then use what we would now describe as artificial intelligence. It does now, along with all of its cousins. But it is a way of harvesting data from consumers for very tiny rewards, which pays enormous commercial dividends. And we give away our data all the time. One of my favorite writers on AI has just published a very good book recently. I'll quote from it later, called Hannah Fry. And Hannah Fry says we will look back on the 1990s and the noughties and this decade in the same way that people now look back on Native Americans when the Europeans landed, who gave away their land and their wealth in exchange for beads. We give away our personal data without any thought of where it might lead, with enormous consequences for our lives and for society. And most of our interaction with technology companies is a transaction where we give data and they give us free stuff that entertains us. And our data is what people are seeking from us. That's the kind of thing that keeps me awake at night and gives me pause as we try and puzzle out together how to live well in this digital world in which the flow of data is going to be so important. So 9 issues just to focus where I think we should be thinking as citizens and also from my perspective as the church as well, and to be aware of. 9 key issues. The first is public awareness, debate, scrutiny, and trust around AI is a very long way behind what the technology is now doing. So the technology is capable of far more than we know is happening. And all of us, I would imagine, if we interact digitally at all, are interacting with artificial intelligence most days of our lives, only it's not called that. When Netflix suggests a video that you might want to watch, or Amazon suggests a book you might want to read, that's an AI-powered decision. When you request a loan from your bank, it's probably an artificial intelligence which is interacting and making that decision for you. In innumerable ways, AI is around us. I think I know quite a bit about this subject, but I sat down and watched the Horizon program 10 days ago called Diagnosis on Demand, The Computer Will See You Now. It's still an iPlayer. It's presented by Hannah Fry, coincidentally. It's a study of the use of AI in medicine, which I was familiar with, and some of the tremendous benefits in AI are about the use of AI in radiology and increased accuracy and speed in mammograms and cancer diagnosis, which is absolutely fantastic. What I didn't know is that a company called Babylon Healthcare have developed an artificial intelligent diagnostic tool. And they have now opened a GP practice in central London. If you are in central London, if you live there, you can register with this GP practice as your GP. It triages you through an AI when you want to see a doctor. And it then gives you an appointment with a GP by Skype within 10 minutes of requesting it. It appeals. Part of the program was about whether it really is as good as a general practitioner, and you can watch that and see. But part of the program is about how Babylon are attracting young, fit patients who like the technology and thereby making unviable GP practices in poorer parts of inner London, who are then left with the non-technologically aware and less fit patients. So a significant risk of undermining a critical aspect of the National Health Service because of technology-driven change harnessed to significant technology companies. We need greater debate, transparency, awareness, and trust. Second issue. Public truth and political debate. The picture is Mark Zuckerberg. The headline relates to him addressing the Senate in the United States because of the Cambridge Analytica scandal earlier this year. Over the last 2 years, there's been quite a lot of debate and discussion about how micro-targeting of political advertising, which deploys artificial intelligence and is delivered through social media, has been persuasive and, many people argue, decisive in the last two American elections, the one which saw Barack Obama elected for a second term and President Trump, so it's blind to political parties, and also in the European referendum in Great Britain and in the last general election and in other elections around the world. This works through the gathering of data from social media. It was thought by legitimate means. The compiling of people's political views and the designing of adverts, which are exactly tailored in American political language to soccer mums or to blue-collar workers or to people of particular persuasions. Because those political adverts don't always look like political adverts, they often look like news, then they are proving immensely persuasive as we live our lives within silos which don't allow for debate from other people's feeds whom with whom we might disagree. The Cambridge Analytica scandal, when it broke, and significantly affected the share value of Facebook, which is the largest company in the world, or one of the largest companies in the world, as a global scandal with a British company in the lead, was an extension of that, because it took the phenomena into the illegal harvesting of data and away from the legal harvesting of data. But even if those loopholes are closed and Facebook changes its ways, that micro-targeting and persuasion by micro-advertising remains a factor and is shifting public debate and public perceptions of truth in a really serious way for democratic institutions. My third issue is AI and the future of work. Artificial intelligence is an extraordinarily disruptive technology and will be disruptive of patterns of work in the United Kingdom and across the world. That disruption will happen. We're not quite sure of the rate in which it will happen, and we're not quite sure of the net effect of it, because one of the unknowns is how many new roles will be created. We can see how many jobs will be lost. We can't see how many new jobs will be generated. One of the great hopes for artificial intelligence, one of the really positive things, is a transformation of productivity in work. And if you know the UK economy, you'll know that productivity has stalled for many years now, and we're not seeing increase in productivity. Artificial intelligence will generate that and will improve it, but at the cost of disruption to many industries. Across the next 5 years, it's thought that the two industries most likely to be affected, or two of the industries most likely to be affected, will be traditional non-skilled labour. So one of them, the picture reflects this, is warehousing and distribution. This is a picture of a high-tech warehouse. You can find lots of articles about them online. And there was a newspaper article in the summer of a high-tech warehouse in Manchester, a low-tech warehouse in Manchester, a traditional warehouse, where 5,000 people are employed. That warehouse is being replaced, and a new warehouse is being built near Leicester, which will do its job, which will be state-of-the-art technology and will employ less than 2,000 people. So we're talking about a 60% unemployment from that one shift alone. We're also saying that the productivity and efficiency gains will be so great that the people who compete with the firm who's doing that will not be able to resist a similar move, because the gains are so severe. So the progress and disruption will be inexorable in these industries. The second is call centres, where it's reckoned that there will be a shift to automation within 5 years, which significantly affects those who work there. I was the Bishop of Sheffield before I came to Oxford for 7 years. South Yorkshire is still affected by the closure of pits in the 1980s. And if you drive across South Yorkshire, you will see the way the economy has been regenerated, because you will see enormous distribution warehouses and call centres. The economic disruptive effects will fall unevenly across the United Kingdom, and it's the traditional heavy industry, post-industrial areas, which will be most affected by these shifts. But the change in employment patterns will be colour-blind also, in that it will be white-collar professions as well as blue-collar professions traditionally, which will be changing. The legal profession, accountancy, human resources are investing significantly in AI, and rightly so, as is health, with significant potential for gain, but also significant disruption. Education has recently been described as the Cinderella of artificial intelligence. It's probably the area where least thought is given to the changes, but that's changing now. Anthony Seldon, former headmaster of Wellington School, now Vice Chancellor of Buckingham University, has recently published a very good book in which he tries to think about how AI might affect education for good. He thinks that the paradigm of a single classroom with 30 people, children of the same age, and one teacher at the front, and parallel learning will be disrupted by AI in the classroom for good if that's used well. And individual learning pathways and people learning at different rates will become the norm, and there are many positive benefits for that. It will also be essential that all people of whatever age learn more about how to live with technology and how to flourish in a digital world. Almost every article about the rising mental health crisis among the young and among adults mentions social media in some way and the dangers of being open to scrutiny in the whole of our lives and 24 hours a day, and what that does to our personalities. So educating one another to live well with technology will be absolutely key, and especially the young. It will also be essential that we are learned and reskilled at different stages of our lives, because the pace of technological change won't be diminished. We will be, as a nation, preparing present and future generations for a different future. And the only way to offset the disruptive nature of the technology on employment will be the call to education. Data protection and data bias. If you've had anything to do with GDPR at work, you're probably, or at church, then you're probably immensely irritated by it. I know I am. GDPR is actually our friend. It's the protection of our personal data is probably one of the most significant things in terms of our personal well-being that we have. And let me read you a section. This is just an excellent book published recently called Hello World by Hannah Fry, who presented the Horizon program. And she's extremely good at storytelling to bring this alive. This is from a section on data and a subheading, The Wild West. Palantir Technologies is one of the most successful Silicon Valley startups of all time. It was founded in 2003 by Peter Thiel of PayPal fame, and at the last count was estimated to be worth a staggering $20 billion. That's about the same market value as Twitter, although the chances are you've never heard of it. I haven't. And yet, trust me when I tell you, Palantir has almost certainly heard of you. Palantir is just one example of a new breed of companies known as data brokers, who buy and collect people's personal information and then resell it or share it for profit. There are plenty of others, a huge swathe of companies you've probably never directly interacted with, but are nonetheless continually monitoring and analyzing your behavior. Every time you shop online, every time you sign up for a newsletter or register on a website, or inquire about a new car, or fill out a warranty card, or buy a new home, or register to vote, every time you hand over any data at all, your information is being collected and sold to a data broker. Remember when you told an estate agent what kind of property you were looking for? Sold to a data broker. Or those details you once typed into an insurance company? Sold to a data broker. In some cases, even your entire browser history can be bundled up and sold on. It's the broker's job to combine all of that data, cross-referencing the different pieces of information they've bought and acquired, and then create a single detailed file on you, a detailed profile of your digital shadow. An ID that contains traces of everything you've ever done. And Hannah Fry goes on to talk about the potential advantages of that, but also the array of problems and the use that can be made of that technology. The Chinese government is extraordinarily good, is investing hugely in the next generation of artificial intelligence. China's investment is now outstripping the investment of Silicon Valley, I believe. One of the things that's very highly developed in China is facial recognition software. Imagine combining the power of facial recognition software with a database instantly accessible of everything you've ever done. There's an experimental point system in China already, which I think enters a new phase in 2020, when people will be prevented from taking certain rail journeys or traveling in certain class on aeroplanes unless their lives can be shown to conform to certain standards. What in the West is peer pressure, in China becomes manipulation of whole populations through data. The second major issue around data is bias. Artificial intelligence learns how to do a particular narrow field of task by practicing on data and then applying what it learns to the wider population. But if that initial data is biased or distorted, then what flows from it is also biased or distorted. Not such a big issue if it's simply about your Amazon book recommendation or your Netflix video. But if it's how many years you should spend in prison, in the use of AI in the sentencing system already happening in the United States, or if it's whether you can get a loan, or whether you are shortlisted for a particular role within your company, then it becomes a really serious thing where that bias is. Growing the AI economy is critical, in the government's current industrial strategy, sets out five challenges. The first of them is to grow the AI economy and make Britain a world leader in AI. I think that's hugely important and significant. We're well placed to do that. We don't have the levels of investment of the United States and China, but among other nations, we are respectable, in a very respectable place. And we have research and entrepreneurs and startups and so on. So expect to hear a lot from the government about digitization and the benefits of the AI economy and the need to invest. I won't focus there particularly, but it is a really important part of where we are. We cannot ignore this as an economy and as a nation, but we need to do it well. Weaponization, like all technology, this technology affects the way the world will wage war. And there are already autonomous weapons in existence, not many. There are already vigorous campaigns to restrict their use through the United Nations. There are already debates at government level and intergovernment level about what the UK's attitude should be. So far, I have to say, the United Kingdom is not engaging well in these debates. We haven't accepted yet the international definitions on autonomous weaponry, which are the first step to being part of treaties which might restrict their use. The picture there is of a drone. A drone is not an autonomous weapon. It is a remote weapon which already raises new ethical issues. Brilliant recent film starring Helen Mirren, which explores that eye in the sky and those ethical issues for the people who are responsible for that weaponry. But autonomous weaponry would go a stage further. I don't know if any of you know the Black Mirror science fiction series. There's one of the Black Mirrors, Metalhead. It's the scariest thing I've seen on television since I watched Doctor Who as a seven-year-old, I think. it took me four attempts to actually get through this episode. And it demonstrates the dangers of the power of autonomous weaponry used against a civilian population. The sexualization of machines and robotics is already a reality and will become more so, just as much of the internet was powered by the pornography industry, sadly. So we must face the reality of the sexualization of machines. There are already brothels which deploy robots with some kind of AI response. That's likely to accelerate. Legislation will be needed in some areas, as will public awareness and debate. And my ninth issue is really the question of leadership and who shapes the future when it comes to artificial intelligence and the use of these technologies. There has been a view that we should just let the technology companies get on with it. There's been a kind of economic and technological determinism which says that we should let the market reign, and if something is possible, then it should be allowed to happen. I think that's a really unwise way of responding to these developments. We urgently need a leadership in these areas in order that we come through to a good way of using and accruing the benefits of what is really fantastic and interesting technology, but which needs to be used for the good of all and not distorted. And I think this is the primary conclusion of the Lords Select Committee on AI, that actually we need to shape this technology, not allow it to shape us. When our report was launched in June, one of the speakers at the launch of the report, who directs one of the Centres for the Internet in the University of Cambridge, Stephen Cave, had a very telling phrase. He said, for the last 20 or 30 years, the motto of the tech industry has been, move fast and break things in order to get it done. And Stephen Cave said, we're discovering that move fast and break things is no longer good enough, because you can break things which are infinitely precious to society, like democracy and truth. And therefore, we need to leave behind the idea that this should be led by technology companies and a very small number of monopolies at that, and actually have much more interaction with public debate and civil society, and a strong ethical framework for that. It was really interesting spending most of a year receiving written evidence and interviewing experts in industry, in different professions, in health, about artificial intelligence on our committee. And one of the things that was said to us in nearly every session we had, we got the message very clearly that the navigation of our society with artificial intelligence needs a much stronger ethical base. The people who are developing the technologies, whether they are the scientists developing machine learning algorithms or those who are applying it to business or accountancy, are saying, we actually need some help with our ethics here. If we're going to develop this well, we actually need to think about how it happens, and we need some ethical leadership. The government has responded to that really positively and was already responding while our committee was at work. And the Prime Minister put forward about a year ago through the budget and then again in January at a speech in Davos, a very strong bid for the United Kingdom to be a leader in the ethics of artificial intelligence. When I first heard that, I was a little bit cynical about it. I thought, well, that's really good. I'm sure everybody thinks we should do that. But is that just a way of being a leader at something? Because we're not going to be the biggest or the best. I've come to believe in it quite deeply now, because as I look at the global picture, it seems to me that one of the drivers of AI are the Silicon Valley technology companies. And their ethical base is not one that I would want to own or recognize. It's traced back to an extreme individualism and libertarianism from the 1960s San Francisco culture. And the other big economic driver will be China. And the ethical base which is emerging there about individuals serving the state is also not one I would want to identify with. I think if there is to be an ethic I would want to recognize and own emerging globally for AI, it will come from within Europe. And I think Britain has a really key part to play in that. So the government is currently developing new instruments to offer ethical monitoring and leadership for this whole industry. But and there'll be, I think, some news in the next few weeks about the next stage of that development. But this, the committee I was part of, tried to develop five overarching principles, offered them for discussion, as it were, having listened to what was going on across the industry, and commended them to our society, really, as five principles which are really important. The first is a headline, that artificial intelligence should be developed for the common good and for the benefit of humanity as a whole. There are tremendous goods in this technology. It has the chance to bring affordable health care to millions of people who don't have access to a doctor but have a smartphone through which they can access things. It has the capacity to speed up diagnosis and tailor a treatment and medicine, to bring education to many different people, and to connect people together in meaningful ways. It has the power to join up carers with the cared and to make knowledge widely available. But its development needs to be for the good of all and not driven by the profit of a few, the enormous profit of a few. And that ethical principle needs to undergird the way government sets about this, the way intellectual property is framed, the way taxation operates internationally, and so on. We have a great deal of work to do. Artificial intelligence should operate on the principles of intelligibility and fairness, that we need to know when we're dealing with an AI. When I get a phone call at the moment from a telephone marketing company, and I answer my phone, and is a rather robotic voice on the other end, asking me if I've ever been in a, though telling me I've been in a car accident recently, then I find that robotic voice immensely irritating. But I'm glad it's there. The technology doesn't yet allow that robotic voice to sound like my father, or sound seductive or human. But it will soon. And I don't want it to. I think we should know when we're dealing with an artificial intelligence and not a human, and that the transparency should be there. There are already a number of virtual programs offering counseling support to people, a therapy through artificial intelligence. You can tell that they are, and at the moment they say they are. I'm just a robot, what do I know, is said every so often. And at the moment they're largely offered free, though some of them are beginning to charge now. But I would hate to make the step where a therapy or therapeutic program was offered by a virtual reality pretending to be a person, which the technology will soon make possible. We need to have transparency and clear labeling. Part of learning to live well in a digital world is taking seriously the things that flash up. I take much more notice now of the irritating notices about cookies online, and I would like to take more notice of the terms and conditions notices that pop up every time you download some software. Somebody has calculated that if you actually read all the terms and conditions notices that you click on in a year, it would take you more than a year to read the terms and conditions notices. And they're so long to stop us reading them. And we, they need to be much shorter in order to be intelligible and fair. We should not be in a position where decisions are made about really important aspects of our lives and can't be explained. People use the language of black box to describe how a machine comes to make a decision. There needs to be transparency, and there needs to be accountability somewhere to a person. AI should not be used to diminish the data rights and privacy of individuals, families, or communities. We shouldn't unknowingly give away important information about ourselves, which can then be used against us. One of Hannah Fry's interesting stories about computer-driven loyalty schemes is that if you use one of these schemes, the supermarkets can tell from quite an early stage when somebody conceives a child. Sometimes before you do, you're fully aware of that. People can, it's claimed that artificial intelligence can detect somebody's sexuality from before they even become aware of it. Certainly, if AI is connected to the increasingly sophisticated wristbands that we wear to monitor health and fitness, it will be able to detect potential for illness, which might be good medically, but might be really bad if you're looking for some kind of health insurance or to make other long-term decisions. So we need to be really careful about that. All citizens have the right to be educated to enable them to flourish mentally and emotionally and economically alongside artificial intelligence. We need to recognize in our legal and ethical frameworks as a country that human flourishing is not just about economics. It's not just about growth of the economy, and it's nor is it simply about economic growth across the range of the economy, but it's also about human flourishing mentally and emotionally as well, and that one of the keys to that is definitely education and access. So we should be prepared to invest a disproportionate amount of our resource in that education for the next generation. And that for me is the key reflection I have when I think about my own grandsons in relation to this whole development, that my eldest grandson, Josiah, started nursery school a few weeks ago. He's already in his education. He needs it to do certain things, and he won't have a second opportunity. And finally, the autonomous power to hurt, destroy, or deceive human beings should never be vested in artificial intelligence. That it will dehumanize us if we give away that power to hurt and deceive and destroy, and that machines need to be accountable to us. And that's one of the great places for thinking about ethical issues in technology is science fiction. And you might recognize in that a fifth principle, if you know your science fiction, Asimov's first law of robotics extended. Science fiction is still, through series like Black Mirror and others, pushing out the boundaries of our thinking and saying, if technology can do this, we need to make sure it can't also do that. So five overarching principles. If you want to read a bit more, here are three books you might want to look at. Hannah Fry's On Your Left, Hello World. Franklin Foer, fascinating book, World Without Mind, published earlier this year. All three have been published in the last 6 months. The Existential Threat of Big Tech traces the values of Facebook and Google and Apple and the philosophy which undergirds them and where they might be going. And then Yuval Noah Harari has written three books, all of which are global bestsellers, Sapiens, Homo Deus, and now 21 Lessons, reflecting on pushing out the thinking of where technology is going. None of these authors writes from a Christian perspective, but they all say really interesting things, which I think as a church we need to attend to. The last thing I want to say is all of these trends and questions and issues are traceable back to one huge question, which is for humankind the question of the age and is raised in an acute form by technology. And it is, what does it mean to be human? This is a quotation from Kevin Kelly, which was a quotation which originally engaged me with the subject in a book given to me by my eldest son called The Inevitable. Kelly is the editor of Wired magazine and is hugely respected in these fields. He says this: we'll spend the next three decades, indeed perhaps the next century, in a permanent identity crisis, asking what humans are good for. He says the greatest benefit of the arrival of artificial intelligence is that AIs will help define humanity. We need AIs to tell us who we are. When I read that, my interest was sharpened significantly. Very frequently, when I'm sitting in rooms of people discussing artificial intelligence, you sometimes see in the audience people's thought bubbles. One of the things gifts you're given as a bishop is to see what's in people's thought bubbles. And one of the thought bubbles I see most often is, what on earth are you doing here? You know, what's a bishop, a minister of the Church of England doing, thinking about AI? And sometimes people even say that to me. And because I enjoy surprising people, I always enjoy it when they do. And actually what I say is this. Well, I think I'm here as a representative of a faith which dares to believe that Almighty God, the creator of heaven and earth, became a person. And we've been reflecting on that for about 2,000 years. And what that means for what it means to be human. And therefore, I think we have something to contribute to this conversation. And I've come to believe more and more deeply, not only that we have something to contribute to the conversation, which is hugely important and worthwhile, but actually our world urgently needs us to make that contribution. Because people do not know the answer to the question that they're asking. And there are within the Christian faith the deepest of resources which help us make that response. Our faith is all about what it means to be human and what it means to flourish together as a society. We have been asking questions within our own community, Jewish and Christian, for thousands of years, based on reflection on the natural world and what it means to be a human person. And the answer to those questions is given to us not on the edge of our tradition, but right in the center. That God becomes a person. That we are who we are because we are loved by God and in relationship with others. And that the deepest meaning of our lives is in those relationships. That actually in our frailty and limits and imperfection are keys to our humanity, as well as in the things that we do well. That our value does not consist of our intelligence or our longevity or our giftedness, but by being loved and finding our community within the community of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And we have a vision of what it means to flourish as a human being, which is one of the deepest, most profound visions of humanity that the world has ever seen. That actually, to flourish and to be happy and blessed is to know our need of God, to be poor in spirit, that to be happy and blessed is to take suffering seriously and mourn and lament as well as rejoice. That actually in humility we find joy and contentment, not in pride. That our vocation is to work for justice and for the good of all, not for the good of some. That we are called to, above all, clothe ourselves with love and mercy and compassion and extend forgiveness to others and to ourselves by the grace of God. That we are called to be deeply authentic as people, pure in heart, living on the outside what we believe on the inside. That we are called to pursue peace and reconciliation in the whole of creation and between people. And that is the goal of creation, all things reconciled in Christ. And that we are called to stand up for what we believe, even when there is a cost to that, as there always is. Because some things are more important, even than our own flourishing and well-being, as we particularly remember on this day of all days. We have in our faith the most profound vision of what it means to be human. And I believe as a church, we need to find the courage to enter this debate and dialogue in conversation and in public discourse and join in what is a profound search taking place across the world. Thank you.
Bishop Stephen, thank you. Thank you for getting our old grey matter going this evening and provoking our thinking and opening our eyes. I'm sure all of us have learned something new this evening and no doubt have been left with lots of questions as well. We're going to have a few minutes now for questions. And so I've got the microphone. I'm in control. Ha ha. But I'd like to open up the opportunity. And so if you'd like to indicate if you've got a question that you'd like to ask Bishop Stephen, then please do so. I should have warned you at the beginning, shouldn't I, that this opportunity was coming. Katrina.
Thank you so much. You said about sort of the UK was leading the way in sort of devising on the ethics of the thing. Yeah. But how likely is it that Silicon Valley and Valley and China are likely to take that on board?
I think it's possible. And I think you can see it happening already. I think one of the most interesting ethical companies which is trying to be ethical is Google at the moment. The Google scientists struck last year because of they discovered that Google was involved in research on autonomous weapons, and they thought that was counterintuitive. And some of that is coming from British and UK influence. So I think it's possible, but also our government and the European governments have a responsibility to legislate. So in the recent budget, I think it was significant, although it won't come until 2020 and it'll be small, that the Chancellor is trying to develop a mechanism for taxation to be returned to the company, to the country which generates the tax. So it will need international agreements, but unless the leadership comes from somewhere, the United States government is not at the moment seeing its role to engage with and take on big tech. So there's a kind of, I would say, an abdication of responsibility there.
Thank you. A great chat, and it was a great talk. I just wondered for many here that you didn't actually define artificial intelligence. And I'm just wondering if that's because it's impossibly difficult to do so, or there's actually an assumption out there that everybody knows what artificial intelligence actually is.
Thank you. It is. There is no single agreed definition. We do have one in the Lord's AI report, the distinction I made at the beginning between general AI and narrow AI is really important. Most AI that's possible now is the narrow AI, and it's the machine computing in a way which is either parallel to or in excess of human ability to do particular tasks. And the most common form is machine learning, which is where lots of data is fed into a set of algorithms, and the machine teaches itself and learns itself from the data how to do a task. You want a really good introduction, if you have Netflix, look at the story of how Google DeepMind built the AlphaGo computer to beat the world Go champion, not by programming the computer to play Go, but by giving it lots of data, and it taught itself how to play.
Thank you for a very thought-provoking reflection. My question is, do you still have any loyalty cards? And if so, what have you learned about how consumers should protect themselves?
Thank you. Yes, I do have loyalty cards, although I have to say I don't use them as diligently as I did. When somebody asks me in a shop, as they did on Friday, can we email you your receipt? I usually say no. So I engage more thoughtfully than I did. And I do so in the knowledge that everything I do will be transparent if it's digital and electronic. So those are there. And I think one of the effects of that is that it is a spur to personal integrity, to being on the inside as you are on the outside, so your life is open to scrutiny.
So, great talk. and rather scary talk, actually, if I'm being really honest with you, as a grandfather. Yeah. How concerned are the government about the use of AI in bringing down financial markets and damaging financial markets, i.e. I'm thinking about China, Russia, things like that?
I think there's a significant degree of concern, and also a concern that's balanced by the investment in cybersecurity and things, and we're seeing a shifting of resources to that. I have to say, across government as a whole, different departments have got different cultures in relation to AI. Education is not really engaged with it very much at all. Defence is very kind of secret about what it's doing. The guy who's the new health secretary, Matt Hancock, actually went from digital culture, media and sport to health and is bringing a great push to digitalise the NHS, which has been until recently the largest purchaser of fax machines in the world and doesn't join its data up. So Matt Hancock's a great enthusiast for technology. Government is not even in its approach to these things, and some departments very much need to catch up.
Thank you very much. You talked about data bias, but I've been reading some stuff recently about bias in the core algorithms. And I imagine the same data analysed by Fox News would look very different when analysed by CNN.
Yeah.
How are people looking at that?
I think the development of algorithms for that, there are two parts to that. One is the company themselves developing them intentionally, and the second is the scrutiny for that company and the skill to read that. So both things are happening. So a company like Fox News would privilege certain kinds of stories, but whether anybody else could scrutinise that, it's less open to scrutiny than if a person is acting and doing it, because at a certain point, the decision-making process has become opaque. You don't quite know why the machine is coming out with certain outcomes. There are ways of guarding against that in some instances, though it is provoking legal questions. For example, increasingly it's the case that there's experimentation with radiology results being scanned by a human and machine working together. Well, who's going to get sued? Is the question the lawyers are asking, if there's a real mistake in that. And if you can't tell how the machine is making its decisions, how can there be proper accountability?
Thank you. I'm over here.
sorry.
I agree with you about phone calls being very irritating when they're trying to sound like they're human. But one of the areas that the Wind Electorate has looked at in the last couple of years is the environment. And your five overarching principles are all great, but they're very human-orientated. And we forget that we're one of the biggest biomasses on the planet and need the rest of the planet to maintain it. And I just wondered what the environment has to say, or what you have to say about the environment and AI.
Thank you. I suppose I slightly defend the five principles, though they're not mine, they're the select committee's, by the common good of all, which would actually include the common good and benefit of humanity, investing in the good of the natural world is in the end a way to benefit all of humanity. I think AI can bring some benefits in terms of environmental care, and I think by improving knowledge and accountability, and also shortening, for example, the need to travel because of better communication, and personally I would say that should be an overt goal of all that we do, and that the technology should be deployed for those purposes. There have been some interesting examples in the last year of global competitions to develop applications of artificial intelligence for the common good, to solve particular problems, including environmental problems. So it is being used in that way.
Bishop Stephen, thank you. I've heard it said that the greatest threat facing humankind is global warming. Now you have spent so long looking at and thinking about artificial intelligence, have you formed an opinion broadly? Is it a threat or an opportunity?
It's both. It's both. And I think I would now say that the greatest challenges for this next generation are climate change and addressing the challenges of technology. And beside artificial intelligence, I would also put biotechnology and the possibilities of human enhancement there, which is a subject I don't know a huge amount about. But I think the way in which we respond to the changes in our environment and the way in which we address the pace and challenge of technological change will define the next century, undoubtedly, for humankind, which is why, I mean, this is a personal view. I am somewhat frustrated at the moment that all our politicians can talk about is redefining our relationship with Europe, which is really important, but on the scale of those challenges, it is not the thing we need to be giving our best energies to.
Thank you. It strikes me as inevitable that the introduction of more and more AI will lead with more and more leisure time. I'm interested to hear how you think we might deploy that leisure time, and does organized religion have a role in helping us to fill that time, or are we all just going to lie on our bunks and be slobs?
Thank you. I think, yes, it's really interesting whether or not it will leave more leisure time. And that depends, I think, on, it's predicated on the benefits of the application of technology being evenly spread across the population. If the benefits of technology are tied to massive growth in inequality, then we might get a very small, wealthy, leisured class and a very large class which has to work very hard to reach levels of sustainability. I do think the churches have a great role to play at all kinds of levels in this emerging world. I think people are asking deep questions. I think there's a paradox of technology that it leads to actually significantly greater isolation and loneliness. As our engagement with technology increases, our measures of loneliness in society go up as well. And I think the breaking down of loneliness through face-to-face community is one of the local church's greatest strengths. And I think the investment of time in both reflection in different ways, which for Christians is prayer and worship, and in service of our neighbor, is a way of introducing purpose and value into human lives, which are separate from our job or profession or work. And churches are vehicles of exactly that kind of human endeavor and community. So I'm really hopeful for the role of the church. I think the world will need the church more than ever before in this next generation.
Bishop, you mentioned right at the beginning about this digital GP service in London. You did mention, you commented that it would have big implications on the NHS, but you didn't actually comment on how effective that kind of a GP service is. Would you comment on that?
Thank you. Yes, I mean, the programme was really interesting and featured Babylon have claimed, and this was what Horizon was exploring, Babylon have claimed that their diagnostic service has now sat the GP final examination, diagnostic examination, which actually my daughter is due to take in a couple of months' time. So I kind of know it a little. Horizon exposed the fact that they hadn't, and that they passed it, and actually done better than the average new GP. Horizon exposed the fact that they hadn't quite done that, and it needs further scrutiny. But undoubtedly, the triaging system and some of the diagnostics are working really well. And the idea that you can have an appointment by technology, by Skype, very quickly is hugely appealing to Londoners, let alone somebody living in Rwanda, which was the other place they filmed. It was quite sobering, though, to see somebody talking to their doctor and holding up their phone so that the doctor could see inside their ear. That face-to-face sometimes is best. But I think Babylon is one to watch. They're making a huge investment, obviously with the hope of a very significant return.
Could I just ask you about how you, I mean, we've been talking about China, Europe, and the United States in particular. How do you see AI affecting the global south? I mean, you've mentioned Rwanda, but I can see it being a sort of a bigger divide. But you see it making a greater divide between the world?
I think it is, yeah. And some really interesting global maps have been produced to give different indicators of engagement with digital technology and AI across continents. And Africa is exposed as the continent where there is least engagement. Not none, but a significantly lower. Different countries are taking different approaches to AI. We had evidence from Germany, who are the German government and industry and universities are seeing AI's applications as simply strengthening their industrial base. Germany makes, they said to us, the best cars, the best domestic appliances, the best manufacturing machines in the world. We want artificial intelligence to enhance that. And that's our horizon. We don't want any metaphysical nonsense, they said to us, basically. So they take an approach. We heard evidence from Korea, where South Korea, Southeast Asia, is really engaging in digital technology and AI. The smart cities thinking in Southeast Asia is extraordinary, and in Korea, and the way transport and other things are joined up. Much will depend, I think, also something I didn't talk about particularly, about transport and self-driving cars and whether that becomes a reality, because that will spread very quickly as well. So, yeah.
Hi, thank you very much. We've heard a lot about medical science and some of the benefits that perhaps artificial intelligence might give to medical science, but it also strikes me that medical science has had for a long time a basis to discuss and regulate the ethics. Mm. And I wondered if you might comment on perhaps parallels we might need in artificial intelligence as well.
Thank you. And I think the government has announced I think we do need more things, and the government has announced the formation of and has already formed, actually, a new Centre for Data Ethics and Innovation, which will be the regulatory authority. The nearest parallel is the Human Embryology Authority, which has regulated that kind of ethical engagement, only this will be a much more broad spread. It already exists as part of DCMS and is going through its initial consultation scoping exercise. So it will sit alongside a new AI council and a group of AI champions to drive this industrial strategy forward safely, is the plan.
And then I'm going to suggest opportunity for one more question. So if you want to be that person, you need to catch my attention very quickly.
Thank you. You mentioned about video games at the beginning of your talk, and I was just wondering to what extent video game companies are involved in artificial intelligence, especially as it's fairly common amongst the youth culture and obviously growing so in the adult culture as well.
Curiously, you'd think it would be one of the industries that would be right at the front of using artificial intelligence, but It doesn't appear to be, from my observation. And I think that's the computer games industry changes and evolves every 2 or 3 years in my experience. So I think it could change quite quickly to use more AI-generated technology. But computer games, have developed over the last 4 or 5 years, either towards a much more solitary experience on handheld devices, and therefore translating what were very familiar games 10 or 20 years ago into a phone or an iPad device, or the big multi-player experience, often paired now with huge prizes and gambling and spectator sport, actually, they're developing in those kinds of ways. So the computer games industry is an enormous industry, and it is making use of artificial intelligence, but it's not one of the drivers of the industry at the moment, as far as I know.
I suppose just bring the thing closer to home. How could you see the church using artificial intelligence to do...
Thank you. I think there are significant things to questions we should negotiate. The Church of England has made a significant investment nationally over the last 2 or 3 years. It's still very recent in digital communication of faith. It does require national. It's too big for a local church or for a diocese. But the new tools that we are seeing now around the A Church Near You website, the digital campaigns for Christmas, are ways of using some of the technology there. And I think that could translate into local church, but you're immediately hitting the questions of data and privacy there to do that really well. So I think we should engage with the new technology, but we should do so carefully and thoughtfully, and not in a way that undercuts either public trust and confidence or the ethos of our own community.
Bishop Stephen, thank you very, very much indeed. It's clear from the number of questions that we've had that you've really got us thinking this evening, and I'm sure that we will continue to do so. Refreshments are served in just a moment, and I've spied some very nice-looking cakes at the back. So please do stay around, and I think Bishop Stephen will be here for a few minutes. If you didn't get opportunity to ask your question, then Bishop Stephen will be here. But please do stay and engage in conversation with one another in just a moment's time. But as we close, may I invite us to pray? Bishop Stephen helpfully reminded us towards the end there that we hold all of this within the context of a God who created heaven and earth and who loves us and who has redeemed us. So I'm going to just lead us very briefly in prayer. And it also just struck me that actually the second collect from evening prayer, which some of you may remember from the Book of Common Prayer, I'm not suggesting that any of you were around nearly 500 years ago when it was first written, but some of you may be familiar with it. And it just struck me as Bishop Stephen was talking that actually those words written so long ago actually are still a very helpful prayer speaking into the topic that we've been thinking about tonight. So just very briefly, before we close, may we pray. Almighty God, we thank you that you created heaven and earth, that you chose to become a human being, that you loved the world so much, and that you have redeemed the world. Thank you for all of the capabilities that you have given to us as human beings. And we pray that you would help us to do our bit, to use our intelligence for the good of all, for the benefit and flourishing of humanity. And would you help us, as we have engaged this subject this evening, to know our need of you in all of this, and to clothe ourselves with love and compassion. O God, from whom all holy desires, all good counsels, and all just works do proceed, give unto your servants that peace which the world cannot give, that both our hearts may be set to obey your commandments, and also that by you we, being defended from the fear of our enemies, may pass our time in rest and quietness through the merits of Jesus Christ, our Saviour and Lord. Amen. And so may you know the peace of God this night as we go from here to our homes and families. Thank you for coming.